Their eyes shone yellow, and the hairs of their hides caught needles of light. She stopped to examine the cattle. He stood feeling the sun on his face the way the cattle did until she turned and faced him. "It's almost completed," she said. "We're coming to the end soon." The canyon was full of long early shadows where night lingered, a damp smell in the breeze. The fire left a flat circle of white ash on the yellow sand, and Teo remembered Batoni's sand painting and the warning that the new ceremonies weren't like the old ones. But he never said that they were not complete, only different. She spread her blue silk shawl open and laid her things in the middle. She'd done her washing the day before, and she'd spread the wet clothes over willows to dry. When he went to get them for her, the blouses and skirts were like bright wings of butterflies settled on the branches. He was careful not to snag them as he took them off the willows, and he folded them awkwardly before he took them back. She laughed when she saw the blouses and skirts, and refolded them. She tucked the pouches of seeds and the small, smooth stones between the folded clothes, and she rolled bundles of cattail reeds and willow twigs in a skirt. She tied the shawl into a bundle and balanced it on top of her head the way Teo had seen the old woman at Laguna do. She grinned at him. "See," she said, parading in front of him. "This is the way I'll go. Just like this." She looked around to see if she had forgotten anything. The imminence of her leaving made him press his feet hard against the ground. "I'll walk you to the road," he said. They walked close together, arms around each other's waist, pulling each other close. A mourning dove called from the tall grass along the wash, and below the cliffs the speckled cattle were grazing. Every step formed another word, thick like yellow pitch oozing from a broken pinon limb, words pressing inside his chest until it hurt. "Don't leave me." But he sucked air through clenched teeth and breathed hard, trapping those words inside. She stopped by a juniper tree at the edge of the road and set her bundle on the ground. The road curved through red clay and junipers uphill to the northeast. Behind them, the road dropped down the gray shale hill to the clay flats of the valley. A year ago, he and Harley had ridden down the road on the burro and mule. But this time, the grass along the road was green and thick, and to the east, south, and west, as far as he could see, the land was green again. "Remember," she said. "Remember everything." He hugged her close and closed his eyes tight over the tears. She picked up the bundle and balanced it on her head with one hand. "I'll see you," she said, starting down the road. At the top of the hill she turned and waved to him. He woke up choking on humid jungle air, but when he pushed back the blanket he was in the cave. And it was his own sweat and heavy breathing that made the air seem damp. The dream had been dark, wet sand shifting above water, quicksand with no bottom or top, no edges. It had quivered and heaved in spasms until he choked. He knew better than to walk the road. He climbed up the big boulders, feeling his way slowly, remembering ledges and cracks in the cliff wide enough for a person to climb to the top of the mesa. He moved each foot carefully because the sound of rocks rolling down and dry branches breaking would echo in the canyon, and if they were close enough, they would know he was getting away. His heart was pounding. They were coming to end it their way. He lay flat on his belly and looked down 100 feet into the canyon. His lungs were burning and his sides ached. He listened for them, but for a long time he heard nothing in the bottom of the narrow canyon but gusts of wind that strayed over the rim of sand rock and blew his hair in his eyes. The moon lacked only a night of being full, and the flat, bare sand rock on the mesa top reflected its light like snow, and he could see his way clearly. He ran north until he hit the wood hauling road, and he followed it east to the Yakoma boundary fence. He trotted along the fence. He stopped to rest and swallowed back his own heavy breathing until he thought his chest would burst. But he had to listen for sounds behind him. The wind was blowing from the west, and it was difficult to be certain, but he thought he heard the low hum of an engine. The wind shifted, and it was from the south then, at his back, and it pushed him along. He was running easily and thinking about what he had to do. On the ridge south of Engine Rock, he stopped to look down at the Acoma Valley and the road. Enchanted Mesa was a dark, silvered shadow rising up from the valley into the sky. There weren't any headlights on the road. He listened, but there was only the wind stirring in the juniper branches, rustling the grass around him. It was a restless, dry wind that felt as if it blew out of dusty, thin years of the past. It smelled of emptiness and loss. He had to bring it back on them. There was no other way. He worked his way down the side of the ridge, winding back and forth across the slope, the way horses did to keep their footing. He eased his feet in, holding the fluted steel edge of the culvert with both hands. He slid his legs and hips inside and ducked his head under. The curved ridges of the culvert pressed against his spine, and he could feel tiny pebbles and fine sand that had been washed inside. He pushed the dry tumbleweeds farther into the pipe with his feet and tried to get comfortable. He would stay there until morning. Then he would wait for someone from Acoma to drive by, someone who didn't know about him. The government didn't go to work until 8 o'clock, and by then he would be far away. He woke up when the sky was dark gray, the transition from night already started. Blackbirds swarmed above the junipers. Their noise increased with the dawn light, and they fluttered and circled their roosting places restlessly. The moon had gone down, and only a few stars still blinked in the west. He slid out of the culvert slowly. His legs were stiff from being drawn up near his belly for warmth. He pulled the collar of his Levi jacket up around his chin and shoved his hands into his pockets. It was still dark along the ground and among the trees, but the sky was getting lighter. The blue-gray streaked with red light, like a belly opening under a knife. A frail, luminous glow pushed out between the edges of horizon and clouds. He watched the shadows carefully, checking up and down the wood-hauling road that came down the broken shale ridge and intersected the Acoma Road. There had been no vehicles all night, but he had to make sure they weren't waiting somewhere for daylight. The tall yellow rice grass and the broken gray shale ridge were undisturbed by outlines of darker objects that didn't belong with the junipers and yuccas. Nothing moved up there. To the west, the yellow sandstone cliffs were beginning to catch the light. In the distance, he saw the windmill where he and Josiah had chased the spotted cattle after they had wandered through the Acoma fence. Somewhere around there, the first gray mule had eaten a poison weed and died. The bones would be scattered in the tall grass around the windmill. It was too early to think of bones, even old gray mule bones. But he realized that all along the valley, the cliffs were full of shallow caves and overhangs with springs. But there were other caves, too, deeper and darker. He turned away. The cloudy yellow sandstone of Enchanted Mesa was still smoky blue before dawn, and only a faint hint of yellow light touched the highest point of the mesa. All things seemed to converge there. Roads and wagon trails, canyons with springs, cliff paintings and shrines, the memory of Josiah with his cattle. But the other was distinct and strong like the violet-flowered weed that killed the mule, and the black markings on the cliffs, deep caves along the valley the Spaniards followed to their attack on Acoma. Yet at that moment in the sunrise, it was all so beautiful. Everything, from all directions, evenly, perfectly balancing day with night, summer months with winter. The valley was enclosing this totality, like the mind holding all thoughts together in a single moment. The strength came from here, from this feeling. It had always been there. He stood there with the sun on his face, and he thought maybe he might make it after all. He walked north on the Acoma Road until the culvert and windmill were out of sight. The sun was climbing, and he could hear warbling meadow birds and mourning doves calling from the tall grass beside the road. The sun was nearing its autumn place in the sky, each day dropping lower, leaving more and more of the sky undilute blue. Before he could hear it, he felt the presence of something. Maybe he felt it through the soles of his boots on the road, vibrations of a vehicle approaching from behind. He stopped and listened until he could hear it, still in the distance, and he started looking for places on the side of the road where he could hide. He argued with himself that he was safe again. He felt strong, and the dread of the night before was gone. But he remembered the army doctors in their dark green government cars, and he moved suddenly from the road into the juniper trees. He knelt and looked between the sparse bottom branches of the tree. It seemed like a long time, and his hands were full of cold sweat when the pickup truck finally appeared. It was moving very slowly, the engine whining in low gear. Leroy's truck. Leroy and Harley. His stomach smoothed out and he felt loose. He was smiling and suddenly close to tears because they had come when he needed friends most. He stepped out from behind the juniper tree and waved both arms above his head. Harley leaned out the window on one elbow. He was wearing a short-sleeve Hawaiian shirt with red and white flowers all over it, and he had a pair of dark glasses in his shirt pocket. Leroy was wearing an old army shirt with the sleeves cut off at the shoulders. Teo knew why Harley was driving. Leroy was so drunk that when he opened the door for Teo, the door handle pulled him off the seat and halfway to the ground. Leroy swayed on the running board, holding the door handle tight, until Teo steadied him and helped him back inside. "Thanks, buddy," Leroy said, staring straight ahead, slouching down on the seat. Harley reached into the big shopping bag and pulled out a can of beer. He handed Teo the opener. "You're just in time for our party," he said. "Oh, celebrating the day we enlisted. When was it you and Rocky signed up?" Teo shook his head. Suddenly he felt thin and dizzy. He was exhausted. Even shoving Leroy back into the truck had made him sweat and breathe hard. "I don't remember," he said, forcing out the words. He was still holding the beer in one hand and the opener in the other. Harley's breath smelled like wine. His eyes were bloodshot. And now he was driving the truck fast, talking all the time. "Hey, man, open it. Start drinking. We're going to have a party." Harley poked Leroy in the ribs with an elbow. "Open it for him." Leroy reached for the opener and beer can unsteadily. He jerked the opener out of Teo's hand, and it fell on the floorboards. "Ah, shit," Leroy slurred the words. "I'll get it." The blood rushed to Teo's head, and he felt around the floorboards blindly for the opener. He gave it to Leroy and sat back on the seat with his eyes closed, breathing hard. "Hey, are you sick or something?" Teo shook his head. Harley must have heard the rumors Emo had started. "Just tired, that's all." Harley didn't slow down for the ruts or bumps, and the truck bounced hard. Leroy leaned hard against Teo. "God damn it, Harley," Leroy yelled. "I can't open it when you drive that way." "Shit, you're too drunk to open it. Here, let me." Harley let go of the steering wheel and grabbed the opener and beer can. He leaned over the steering wheel, steadying it with his chest while he punched open the can. Beer spurted out in a foamy spray. Harley shoved it into Teo's lap. He held his hand over it tight. His shirt and pants were soaked with beer. Leroy was laughing. It was beer dripping off his face. Harley had the accelerator all the way to the floor. The truck was swaying from one side of the road to the other, spinning up rocks and gravel that struck the underside of the truck. "Hey, you gonna drink it or spill it?" Leroy laughed while Teo tried to get the can to his mouth without spilling it or being thrown against the dashboard. The foam was warm. It stung his tongue. "You guys got a head start on me, don't you?"
"We've been at it all night,"
Leroy said, blinking his eyes, trying to focus on Teo's face.
"Driving around all night, huh, Harley? Didn't we?"
"Never listen to a drunk," Harley said to Teo.
"This guy doesn't remember nothing. We were in Gallup last night."
Teo tried to look at Harley's face when he said that, but Harley was looking away, over his elbow, out the window. He swallowed some more warm beer and tried to think calmly. The pickup had come from the south, down the Acoma Road. So how could they have been in Gallup the night before unless they had taken the wagon road and come over the mesa the back way from McCarty's? But they usually stayed on 66, where there was a bar every 10 or 15 miles, or every six-pack, as Harley liked to say. Harley and Leroy were his buddies, his friends, but he was feeling something terrible inside, and his heart was beating hard now from what Leroy had said about driving around all night. They had come from the direction he had come, behind him, following him. He gripped the can tight, trying to squeeze away the shaking in his hands. He finished the beer and threw the can out the window. He looked back and watched it bounce into the tall grass and tumbleweeds beside the road. He breathed deeply and closed his eyes. He had to relax and get hold of these thoughts before they scattered in all directions like a herd of sheep. These guys were his friends. Leroy fumbled with another beer.
Too damn drunk to open them anymore. Have to sober up some before I can open any more.
Teo opened it for him. He opened one for himself and leaned back on the seat. Beer made the feeling recede and slowed down the beating of his heart. The truck's motion and the beer were soothing. The steel and glass closed out everything. The sky, the land were distant then. Trees and hills moved past the windshield glass like movie film. It would be easy to get lost in this place of theirs, where the past, even a few hours before, suddenly lost its impact and seemed like a vague dream compared to these sensations. The motion, vibrations of wheels against the road, the warmth of beer in the belly, and the steel cab snug around them. He would rest there and not think about the night before. He needed to rest for a while and not think about the story or the ceremony. Otherwise it would make him crazy and even suspicious of his friends. And without friends he didn't have a chance of completing the ceremony. She'd been right once already when she told him to leave the Springs. So he would hang around with Harley and Leroy. Everyone would understand that. Riding around, drinking with his buddies. They wouldn't be suspicious then. They wouldn't think he was crazy. He'd just be another drunk Indian. That's all. He woke up sweating. The sun was shining through the windshield and the windows were rolled up. The truck was parked at the foot of a rocky little hill covered with cholla. Harley and Leroy were gone. The heat in the cab made him weak and sluggish. He rolled down the window and hung his head out. The beer vomit ran down the truck door into the dry weeds. His head was pounding, and he was thirsty. He got out of the truck and could hardly stand up. The muscles of his legs were stiff. He looked around to see where Harley and Leroy were. The country was dry, and the hills were covered with dark lava rock. The earth was eroded to gray clay, and deep arroyos cut through the length of the valley between the mesas. These were the hills northwest of Canyoncito. He sat down on a big gray rock by a cholla. Grayish-green salt brushes had taken over the areas between the crisscross of big arroyos. South, in the distance, he could see one big cottonwood tree, the only bright green in that valley. It was growing on the edge of the deepest arroyo, its web of roots exposed, held upright by a single connecting root. The bank of the arroyo was undercut so deeply that a strong gust of wind would topple the big tree. A dry, hot wind glided up and down the canyon restlessly, shaking the salt bushes and sweeping dust over the tire tracks. His head hurt every time he took a step. Shock waves of a foot against the ground registered on skull drums. He was looking for footprints. He listened, and there was nothing but the sound of the wind, like a hawk sweeping close to the ground, whirring wings of wind that called back years long past and the people lost in them, all returning briefly in a gust of wind. The feeling lasted only as long as the sound, but he wanted to go with them, to be swept away. It was difficult then to call up the feeling the stories had. The feeling of Te'e and old Batoni. It was easier to feel and to believe the rumors. Crazy. Crazy Indian, seeing things, imagining things. The sun was hot and the sweat was crawling down his head like little black ants. Then he saw their footprints going up the hill. He could see the pebbles and rocks they had knocked loose and the dry grass crushed under boot heel prints. Teo was halfway to the top of the hill before he stopped. Suddenly it hit him in the belly and spread to his chest in a single surge. He knew then that they weren't his friends, but had turned against him, and the knowledge left him hollow and dry inside, like the locust's shell. He wasn't sure why he was crying, for the betrayal, or because they were lost. Then he heard voices, low and steady tones from the top of the hill. He didn't like the way his heart pounded, because it kept him from hearing, but his head was clear and his legs were solid. Fear made him remember important things. He moved down the hill, careful not to knock loose any rocks or step in the dry tumbleweeds. He knew why he had felt weak and sick. He knew why he had lost the feeling Tse'e had given him, and why he had doubted the ceremony. This was their place, and he was vulnerable. He lifted the hood of the truck and started pulling at the ignition wires, trying to remember how the guys overseas hot-wired army jeeps. He reached under the truck seat and found a rusty screwdriver. The wires were a tangled bundle, and his hands were shaking. His mouth was dry, and his tongue stuck to his lips when he tried to moisten them. He looked up at the top of the hill and then around at the sky and the canyon. The sun was moving down in the sky, but the heat still danced above the salt bushes in the canyon. He slipped the screwdriver into his hip pocket and started running. When years before they had first come to the people living on the Sabayeta land grant, they hadn't said what kind of mineral it was. They were driving U.S. government cars, and they paid the land grant association $5,000 not to ask questions about the test holes they were drilling. The cloudy orange sandstone mesas and the canyons between them were dry that year. Ever since the New Mexico territorial government took the northeast half of the grant, there hadn't been enough land to feed the cattle anyway. It was overgrazed. Rain eroded big arroyos in the gray clay, and the salt bush took hold. There was nothing there the people could use anyway, no silver or gold. The drought had killed off most of the cattle by then, so it really didn't matter if a square mile of land around the mine area was off limits, with high barbed wire fences around it and signs in both Spanish and English warning them to keep out. Early in the spring of 1943, the mine began to flood with water from subterranean springs. They hauled in big pumps and compressors on flatbed trucks from Albuquerque. The big trucks sank past their axles in the blow sand, and they hired men from Bibo and Mokino to dig around the tandem wheels and to attach tow chains from the trucks to the big tow truck that came. But later in the summer, the mine flooded again, and this time no pumps or compressors were sent. They had enough of what they needed, and the mine was closed. But the barbed wire fences and the guards remained until August 1945. By then they had other sources of uranium, and it wasn't top secret anymore. Big gray vans came and hauled the machinery away. They left behind only the barbed wire fences, the watchman's shack, and the hole in the earth. Sabayeta people salvaged lumber and tin from the shack, but they had no use for the barbed wire anymore. The last bony cattle wandering the dry canyons had died in choking summer dust storms. Waves of heat caught him, and his legs and lungs were vapor without sensation. Only his memory of running and breathing kept him moving and alive. He stumbled and ran behind the sun, not following, but dragged with it across arroyos, over mesas and hills. At sundown, he was lying on the sand at the bottom of a long mesa, feeling the heat recede from the air and from his body into the earth. The wind came up, and he shivered. He crawled through the strands of barbed wire. Twilight was giving way to darkness. He scooped water off the top of thick green moss that clogged the steel water trough under the windmill. The water was still warm from the sun, and it tasted bitter. He sat on the edge of the trough and looked across the wide canyon at the dark mine shaft. Maybe the uranium made the water taste that way. The sandstone and dirt they had taken from inside the mesa was piled in mounds, in long rows, like fresh graves. Old Grandma told him while he was still sick and weak, lying in the darkened room. She shuffled in and sat down on the edge of the bed.
"I've been thinking of something," she said. "It happened while you were gone. I had to get up the way I do to use the chamber pot. It was still dark. Everyone else was still sleeping. But as I walked back from the kitchen to my bed, there was a flash of light through the window. So big, so bright, even my old clouded-up eyes could see it. It must have filled the whole southeast sky. I thought I was seeing the sunrise again, but it faded away. And by that time, all the dogs around here were barking, like that time the bear was prowling around the trash pile. You remember that, Sonny, how they barked? My, my, I said to myself, I never thought I'd see anything so bright again."
She was patting his arm as she talked, tapping out the story with her hand.
"Your auntie laughed at me when I told her what I saw, but later on that day Romero came around. He said he saw it too, so bright that it blinded him for a moment. Then later on he could still see it flashing when he closed his eyes."
She paused, as if she were trying to think of the right words.
"You know, I have never understood that thing I saw. Later on, there was something about it in the newspaper. Strongest thing on this earth. Biggest explosion that ever happened. That's what the newspaper said."
She was shaking her head slowly from side to side.
"Now I only wonder why, grandson. Why did they make a thing like that?"
"I don't know, Grandma," he had answered then, but now he knew. He had been so close to it, caught up in it for so long that its simplicity struck him deep inside his chest. Trinity Site, where they exploded the first atomic bomb, was only 300 miles to the southeast at White Sands. And the top-secret laboratories where the bomb had been created were deep in the Jemez Mountains, on land the government took from Cochiti Pueblo. Los Alamos, only 100 miles northeast of him now, still surrounded by high electric fences and the ponderosa pine and tawny sand rock of the Jemez Mountain Canyon, where the shrine of the twin mountain lions had always been. There was no end to it. It knew no boundaries. And he had arrived at the point of convergence where the fate of all living things, and even the earth, had been laid. From the jungles of his dreaming, he recognized why the Japanese voices had merged with Laguna voices, with Josiah's voice and Rocky's voice. The lines of cultures and worlds were drawn in flat dark lines on fine light sand, converging in the middle of witchery's final ceremonial sand painting. From that time on, human beings were one clan again, united by the fate the destroyers planned for all of them, for all living things, united by a circle of death that devoured people in cities 12,000 miles away, victims who had never known these mesas, who had never seen the delicate colors of the rocks which boiled up their slaughter. He walked to the mine shaft slowly, and the feeling became overwhelming. The pattern of the ceremony was completed there. He knelt and found an ore rock. The gray stone was streaked with powdery yellow uranium, bright and alive as pollen. Veins of sooty black formed lines with the yellow, making mountain ranges and rivers across the stone. But they had taken these beautiful rocks from deep within earth, and they had laid them in a monstrous design, realizing destruction on a scale only they could have dreamed. He cried the relief he felt at finally seeing the pattern, the way all the stories fit together. The old stories, the war stories, their stories, to become the story that was still being told. He wasn't crazy. He had never been crazy. He had only seen and heard the world as it always was. No boundaries, only transitions through all distances and time. He turned. The moon was rising above the last mesa he had crossed from the east. A transition was about to be completed. The sun was crossing the zenith to a winter place in the sky, a place where prayers of long winter nights would call out the long summer days of new growth. Tonight the old priests would be praying for the force to continue the relentless motion of the stars. But there were others who would be working this night, casting loose counter-motions to suck in a great spiral, swallowing the universe endlessly into the black mouth, their diagrams in black ash on cave walls outlining the end in motionless dead stars. But he saw the constellation in the north sky, and the fourth star was directly above him. The pattern of the ceremony was in the stars, and the constellation formed a map of the mountains in the directions he had gone for the ceremony. For each star there was a night and a place. This was the last night and the last place, when the darkness of night and the light of day were balanced. His protection was there in the sky, in the position of the sun, in the pattern of the stars. He had only to complete this night, to keep the story out of the reach of the destroyers for a few more hours, and their witchery would turn upon itself, upon them. Arrow Boy got up after she left. He followed her into the hills, up where the caves were. The others were waiting. They held the hoop and danced around the fire four times. The witch man stepped through the hoop. He called out that he would be a wolf. His head and upper body became hairy like a wolf, but his lower body was still human. "Something is wrong," he said. "Kokoyo magic won't work if someone is watching us." The headlights appeared suddenly from the northeast, tiny points of light blinking as the vehicle bounced over the road. The small hairs on his neck bristled, but he reasoned with himself. Many land-grant people and white ranchers use that road too. He would know soon if the vehicle kept going west, or if it turned south down the sandy road overgrown with weeds and came toward the mine. Cold moved over him when the headlights turned, bigger now, visibly weaving down the road. He could hear the hum of the engine now. They were coming. He ran past the shaft of the boulders that had been bulldozed away from the opening. The night was getting colder. He could see the steam from his breath in the moonlight. He climbed up boulders big as boxcars and squeezed himself into a hollow space between them. It was warm there. The sand rock still held the sun's heat. He leaned forward and pressed his forehead against the narrow opening so that he could see everything. He expected Leroy's pickup truck, but as the vehicle rounded the last curve before the mine, he could see it was a car. For an instant, he thought it might be land-grant people, and his muscles tensed, ready to jump down and run to flag them down for a ride. But there was something too familiar about the sound the car made. A broken muffler sound he had heard before. Emo. Someone got out and raised the car hood. The other door opened and two more got out. He could hear voices and the sound of water splashing on the ground. He recognized Pinky's laugh. He smelled a fire, and saw three figures bending over a small fire. It flared up suddenly, and he saw their faces. Leroy, Pinky, and Emo. But Harley was missing. They were feeding dry tumbleweeds to the fire, holding them high over their heads and circling the fire before they let go, and the tumbleweeds exploded into fiery balls that lighted up the area around the windmill where the car was parked. They had a bottle they passed between them, and Leroy staggered when he walked down the old barbed wire fence, gathering tumbleweed tangled in the bottom wire. Pinky pounded on the hood of the car, and the metallic booming echoed against the sandstone across the narrow valley. Teo's knees and elbows hurt from resting against the rock. He dropped to his belly and pulled his head back, away from the crack between the rocks. The destroyers. They would be there all night, he knew it, working for drought to sear the land, to kill the livestock, to stunt the corn plants and squash in the gardens, leaving the people more and more vulnerable to the lies. And the young people would leave, go to towns like Albuquerque and Gallup, where bitterness would overwhelm them. And they would lose their hope and finally themselves in drinking. The witchery would be at work all night, so that the people would see only the losses, the land and the lives lost since the whites came. The witchery would work so that the people would be fooled into blaming only the whites and not the witchery. It would work to make the people forget the stories of the creation and continuation of the five worlds. The old priests would be afraid, too, and cling to ritual without making new ceremonies as they always had before, the way they still made new buffalo dance songs each year. Nemo pulled down the collapsed frame of the watchman's shed and threw the boards on the fire. The flames extended the circle of light. Pinky dropped the tire iron. It clattered down the front fender to the ground. They stood behind the car, passing the bottle, taking long swallows, pointing over to the mine shaft and into the rocks where he was hiding. He wondered if they knew he was there, or if they were only planning something else. He wondered if they had tracked him like a thirsty animal, certain they would find him near the only source of water in that area. He was hungry, and he felt shaky and weak. He hadn't eaten since Te'e had left, and he had vomited all the beer. The warmth from the stone was beginning to fade. His Levi jacket was thin, and he could feel the cold leaking through worn places at the elbows and under the arms. He had seen them now, and he was certain. He could go back to tell the people. He was in no condition to confront them. He watched how slowly the moon was rising and hunched his shoulders against the cold. He would be lucky just to make it home that night. He looked down at them. If he hadn't known about their witchery, they might have fooled him. People had been drinking out in the hills on wood hauling roads and sheep camp roads since they first bootlegged liquor to Indians. Standing around the fire, passing cheap wine around, Pinky smashed the empty bottle against the water trough. There were circles of charcoal, tire tracks off side roads, and since the men came back from the war, broken bottle glass all over the reservation. His throat got tight. He might be wrong about them. Harley had helped him last year. He had come and got him moving again. He was exhausted. The fear and the running from that day and from the night before had left him weak. He needed to rest. This ceremony was draining his endurance. He couldn't feel anything then, not for Josiah or Rocky, and not for the woman. Maybe the other Navajos had been right about old Batoni. Nemo and Pinky kept him there. Pinky found the tire iron and was pounding the hood of the car again. The sound set his teeth on edge and angered him in a way he hadn't felt since the day he had stabbed Nemo. It was the sound of witchery, smashing through the night, shrill and cold as black metal. It was the empty sound of his nightmares. Even the voices he recognized. He covered his ears with both hands and ground his molars together. The pounding stopped with the scream. He moved forward suddenly, bruising his knees on the rock. The trunk lid was raised and they were standing around it. The screaming was coming from inside the trunk. He pressed his forehead against the rock until he could feel its print on his skin. He turned his head with his ear between the rocks, frantically trying to catch the sound. Harley. He watched them drag him into the light from the coals. Pinky dropped something into the coals, and the fire sprang up. It was Harley's red and white Hawaiian print shirt, but in a moment, the fire turned the white print bloody red. Leroy and Nemo stripped off his jeans, and Pinky dropped them into the fire. Harley twisted and rolled on the ground. His hands and feet seemed to be tied. Pinky dropped his boots into the fire. Their soles made thick black smoke, and the light from the fire was temporarily obscured. Harley screamed again, and this time Teo climbed out from the boulders. He heard laughter, and when he looked around the corner of the boulder, his heart went numb in his chest, and he wasn't sure of his own rapid breathing anymore. In the moonlight, he could see Harley's body hanging from the fence, where they had tangled it upright between strands of barbed wire. Harley's brown skin had gone as pale as the cloudy sandstone in the moonlight, and Teo could see blood shining on his thighs and his fingertips. He reached into his hip pocket for the screwdriver. He felt the wooden handle and the sharp edges at the end. Squatting close to the ground, he followed the long shadow cast by the continuous mounds of mining debris. He knew what they were doing. Harley had failed them, and all that had been intended for Teo had now turned on Harley. There was no way the destroyers could lose. Either way, they had a victim and a corpse. He was close enough to hear them.
"We told you to watch him. We told you to stay there.
We told you. We told you, and now you know what you got for yourself."
Pinky held his leg, and Leroy cut the whirl from the bottom of his big toe. Harley screamed hoarsely. The sound trailed off to a groan.
"Scream," Emo said. "Scream loud so he can hear you."
The screwdriver was slippery in his hands. It nauseated him to see Harley's body jerking and twitching in the sagging barbed wire, with hands and knives so greedy for human flesh. He fought back a bitter stomach taste. The sweat was running down from under his arms, following the hollow ridges of his ribs. He had to hug his arms close to his side to hold off the shivering. They had a paper bag they had emptied of wine bottles. Emo was holding it with the palm of his hand supporting the bottom of the bag because it was soaked with blood, and the brown paper was beginning to dissolve around the bleeding chunks of human skin. Emo shifted the bag to his other hand and held the bloody palm up to Harley. But Harley's eyes were closed, and he didn't seem to be conscious of anything Emo said.
"Look at this, you half-breed, white son of a bitch. You can't hide from this. Look, your buddy Harley."
Emo jumped forward with a bottle of wine. It splashed over the ground at Harley's feet, and unlike the blood, which clotted in shiny lumps on the sand, the wine soaked in thin and quick.
"Have some, buddy,"
Emo said as he shoved the bottle into Harley's mouth. The glass against teeth made a brittle grinding sound, and Teo heard Harley groan. He closed his fingers around the screwdriver and squeezed it until it was part of his hand. He understood that Harley had bargained for it. He realized that Harley knew how it would end if he failed to get the victim he had named. But Teo couldn't endure it any longer. He was certain his own sanity would be destroyed if he didn't stop them and all the suffering and dying they caused. The people incinerated and exploded, and little children asleep on streets outside Gallup bars. He wasn't strong enough to stand by and watch anymore. He would rather die himself. He knew he could get to Emo before Pinky or Leroy could stop him. They were drunk. Emo's words were thick and slurred. Pinky had stumbled to his knees beside Leroy, squatting next to the fire. He visualized the contours of Emo's skull. The GI haircut exposed thin bone at the temples, bone that would flex slightly before it gave way under the thrust of the steel edge. The wind came suddenly and fanned the coals into yellow flames. Leroy jumped back and stumbled hard against Pinky. Pinky pushed him away, and Leroy fell.
"You fucking little queer!"
Leroy kicked sand in his face, and Pinky lunged at him. Emo stood close to them. The fat under his chin was wrinkled with his grinning. The fire's reflection made two flashing yellow eyes on Emo's glasses. The wind was moving clouds rapidly across the sky, and as they crossed over the moon, Darkness and light rolled back and forth, like the men wrestling on the ground. The sand their feet kicked loose made a swirling trail in the wind. The wind made his sweat go cold. This was the time. But his fingers were numb, and he fumbled with the screwdriver as he tried to rub warmth back into his hands. There would be no one to help Imo. But Teo stayed on his knees in the shadows. Leroy had a knee on Pinky's throat, and he could hear raspy choking sounds. Imo was laughing loudly, pointing at the body hanging stiffly, swaying a little in the gusts of wind, then pointing at Leroy kneeling on Pinky's throat. The moon was lost in a cloud bank. He moved back into the boulders. It had been a close call. The witchery had almost ended the story according to its plan. Teo had almost jammed the screwdriver into Emo's skull the way the witchery had wanted, savoring the yielding bone and membrane as the steel ruptured the brain. Their deadly ritual for the autumn solstice would have been completed by him. He would have been another victim, a drunk Indian War veteran settling an old feud, and the army doctors would say that the indications of this end had been there all along, since his release from the mental ward at the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles. The white people would shake their heads, more proud than sad that it took a white man to survive in their world, and that these Indians couldn't seem to make it. At home, the people would blame liquor, the army, and the war. But the blame on the whites would never match the vehemence the people would keep in their own bellies, reserving the greatest bitterness and blame for themselves, for one of themselves they couldn't save. He crouched between the boulders and laid his head against the rock to look up at the sky. Big clouds covered the moon, but he could still see the stars. He had arrived at a convergence of patterns. He could see them clearly now. The stars had always been with them, existing beyond memory, and they were all held together there. Under these same stars, the people had come down from White House in the north. They had seen mountains shift and rivers change course and even disappear back into the earth. But always there were these stars. Accordingly, the story goes on with these stars of the old war shield. They go on, lasting until the fifth world ends, then maybe beyond. The only thing is, it has never been easy. They heaved the body into the trunk and slammed the trunk lid and car doors shut. The red taillights shrank into the distance. The chalky ring of ashes merged into the moonlight. The wind gusted across the tire tracks and imprints of human shoulders and hands. And there was nothing left but broken bottles and a black mark on the ground where the fire had been. He would go back there now, where she had shown him the plant. He would gather the seeds for her and plant them with great care in places near sandy hills. The rainwater would seep down gently, and the delicate membranes wouldn't be crushed or broken before the emergence of tiny fingers, roots and leaves pressing out in all directions. The plants would grow there like the story, strong and translucent as the stars. His body was lost in exhaustion. He kept moving, his bones and skin staggering behind him. He dreamed with his eyes open that he was wrapped in a blanket in the back of Josiah's wagon, crossing the sandy flat below Powhatan Hill. The cholla and juniper shivered in the wind, and the rumps of the two gray mules were twin moons in front of him. Josiah was driving the wagon. Old Grandma was holding him. Rocky whispered, "My brother." They were taking him home. The creosote and tar smell of the railroad tracks woke him from the dreaming. The cinders made hollow crunching noises under his boots. He had come a long way with them, but it was his own 2 feet that got him there. He stepped high over the steel rails and went down the cinderbank roadbed toward the river. When he felt the dampness of the river, he started running. The sun was pushing against the gray horizon hills, sending yellow light across the clouds, and the yellow river sand was speckled with the broken shadows of tamarack and river willow. The transition was completed. In the west and in the south, too, the clouds with round, heavy bellies had gathered for the dawn. It wasn't necessary, but it was right. And even if the sky had been cloudless, the end was the same. The ear for the story and the eye for the pattern were theirs. The feeling was theirs. We came out of this land, and we are hers. In the distance, he could hear big diesel trucks rumbling down Highway 66 past Laguna. The leaves of the big cottonwood tree had turned pale yellow. The first sunlight caught the tips of the leaves at the top of the old tree and made them bright gold. They had always been loved. He thought of her then. She had always loved him. She had never left him. She had always been there. He crossed the river at sunrise. Hummingbird and Fly thanked him. They took the tobacco to Old Buzzard. "Here it is. We finally got it, but it sure wasn't very easy."
"Okay," Buzzard said. "Go back and tell them I'll purify the town."
And he did. First to the east, then to the south, then to the west, and finally to the north. Everything was set straight again after all that Kokoyo magic. The storm clouds returned. The grass and plants started growing again. There was food, and the people were happy again. So she told them, "Stay out of trouble from now on. It isn't very easy to fix up things again. Remember that next time some Kokoyo magician comes to town." At the center of the kiva, Old Man Kuush was poking kindling into the pot-bellied stove. The new adobe floor was still curing, and the hairline cracks weren't yet filled with plaster. The whitewash was only partially completed, and the kiva murals were veiled under the white clay wash, not yet repainted for the winter ceremonies. The old men nodded at a folding steel chair with St. Joseph Mission stenciled in white paint on the back. He sat down, wondering how far the chair had gone from the parish hall before it came to the kiva. He looked at them sitting in the wooden benches that went all the way around the long kiva. They nodded at him, and when Kuush was satisfied with the fire, he joined them. In the southwest corner there were boxes and trunks with tarps pulled over them to protect them from uninitiated eyes. It took a long time to tell them the story. They stopped him frequently with questions about the location and the time of day. They asked about the direction she had come from and the color of her eyes. It was while he was sitting there, facing southeast, that he noticed how the four windows along the south wall of the kiva had a particular relationship to this late autumn position of the sun. "Amu'u, you say you have seen her. Last winter, up north, with Mountain Lion the hunter. All summer she was south, near Aku." They started crying. The old men started crying, "Amu'u, Amu'u, you have seen her. We will be blessed again." At noon, one of old grandma's grandnieces brought Kuush two lard pails. The steam from one smelled like red chili stew. The other was full of oven bread and pieces of fried bread. They passed around the pail of stew, using pieces of bread to scoop out the meat and to soak up the chili. When they had finished, he followed them to the back of the kiva, where the gourd dipper floated on top of the water pail. He drank last, and after he drank, Kuush poked at the fire and dropped the dipper into the flames. When the sun was dropping near the center of the west window, they stood up. They were going home to rest and eat supper. They'd be back later, after dark, Old Man Kuush told him. He could have water, but no food. He wasn't to leave the kiva. Kuush showed him an old enamel chamber pot with a lid. He said to drink the water, cupping it in the hands. They unraveled the dead skin Coyote threw on him. They cut it up, bundle by bundle. Every evil which entangled him was cut to pieces. They found Harley and Leroy together in the big boulders below the road off Powhatan Hill. The old GMC pickup was crushed around them like the shiny metal coffin the veterans' office bought for each of them. In that way, it wasn't much different than if they had died at Wake Island or Iwo Jima. The bodies were dismembered beyond recognition, and the coffins were sealed. The morning of the funeral, an honor guard from Albuquerque fired the salute. Two big flags covered the coffins completely, and it looked as if the people from the village had gathered only to bury the flags. Auntie talked to them now the way she had talked to Robert and old Grandma all those years, with an edge of accusation about the surface between her words. But after old man Ku'ush had come around, her eyes dropped from his face as if there were nothing left to watch for. But she said that now the women at church came to her privately, after Mass or before the bingo games, to ask her how she had managed all those years to face the troubles which had been dropped into her lap. And she remarked to old Grandma, dozing beside her stove with the dial turned all the way to high, and to Teo, who was oiling his hunting boots, "I tell them it isn't easy. It never has been easy, I say." She came in from Mass that morning with a look of triumph. "Pinky finally got killed," she said, without even bothering to remind them she had said it would happen all along, ever since he had lost those sheep of hers while he was at their sheep camp. "How did it happen?" "Yes, what happened?" old Grandma said, coming out of a doze to sit up straight in her chair. "He was washing dishes at Saraceno's sheep camp." "Oh, that lazy old thing," old Grandma said. "How could he have been washing dishes? Remember how I warned you, Teo? I told you I didn't want that crowd hanging around our ranch with their drinking and carrying on."
"Was Emo there?" Teo asked.
"Well, he was the one. He did it. Pinky was standing there washing dishes in a pan on top of the stove. The others were sitting around the table drinking. They said there were empty beer cans and wine bottles all over the place. Anyway, they say they got to playing around with that rifle Saraceno keeps there."
Old Grandma scuffed her slippers against the floor in front of her chair and rattled her cane against the chair leg.
"Dear, could you give Teo that money in my pocketbook? I think my stove is getting low on oil."
She buttoned the top buttons of her old black sweater and pulled her shawl up around her chin.
"Mama," Auntie said, "I'm trying to tell you how poor Pinky got killed instantly. Shot in the back of the head. Besides, Robert filled it yesterday."
Old Grandma acted as if she didn't hear what Auntie said.
"Is he in jail?"
"The FBI called it an accident." Auntie shook her head. "After all the trouble he made for us, that time with Teo. But I heard they told him to go away. They told him to never come back around here. The old man said that. They told him." Auntie paused. "I heard he went to California," she said.
"California," Teo repeated softly. "That's a good place for him."
Old Grandma shook her head slowly and closed her cloudy eyes again.
"I guess I must be getting old," she said. "Because these goings-on around Laguna don't get me excited anymore."
She sighed and laid her head back on the chair.
"Seems like I already heard these stories before. Only thing is, the names sound different."
Whirling darkness started its journey with its witchery, and its witchery has returned upon it. Its witchery has returned into its belly. Its own witchery has returned all around it. Whirling darkness has come back on itself. It keeps all its witchery to itself. It doesn't open its eyes with its witchery. It has stiffened with the effects of its own witchery. It is dead for now. It is dead for now. It is dead for now. It is dead for now.
Sunrise, accept this offering. Sunrise.
The End. You've been listening to Ceremony by Leslie Mormon Silco, narrated by Pete Bradbury and directed by Natanya Johnson. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.